Joshua chapter 22. It was in June of 2007 that a man by the name of Xavier Alvarez was bragging on a bus tour about having received the Congressional Medal of Honor while serving in the military. Melissa Campbell, a Marine Corps veteran who had served for 10 years, an event planner for that trip, and she was passing out snacks when she heard him making these brags, and she found out that that claim and others were exaggerated claims. She exposed Alvarez as a fraud, and he was later convicted and sentenced to probation and community service. Miss Campbell, for having exposed him, was fired. Her employer told her, quote, "It was unprofessional to confront him," end quote, as she had done that bus trip. I'm thankful for somebody like that who exposed the fraud. I'm thankful for somebody like that who confronted somebody when she saw that somebody was being deceitful. She got in trouble for confronting someone about his lies. I find that that same mentality of no confrontation has crept into the thinking of Christians. In order to gain a hearing for the gospel, many Christians claim that we need to contextualize the gospel. They say that if we contextualize the gospel, that's the only way we're going to have an impact in our culture. By contextualizing the gospel, they mean that we need to adopt things out of our culture and not confront our culture. One such proponent of this contextualizing is a man by the name of Mark Driscoll. Mark Driscoll is the former pastor of Mars Hill Church in Seattle. In his sermons, to communicate the gospel as he said it, he would quote people like Madonna, The Simpsons. He would use vulgar language and questionable jokes, so much so that he became known as the cussing pastor. I referred to him a couple of weeks ago. And in order to contextualize the gospel, he uses loud rock music in his church. All of this in order to bridge a gap, he says, to the unsaved, and to reach young people who are bored with church. So let's contextualize. Let's not confront. You know, Jesus said to his disciples, "You are the sugar of the earth." But that's the way those people would take it. What did Jesus say? "Ye are the salt of the earth." We know that salt seasons, preserves, and purifies. But we also know that salt can irritate. I appreciate this quote from Pastor Todd Brainerd, who pastors down in Florida. He said, "The most uncomfortable place on earth for a lost sinner is in the presence of a consecrated Christian. The pure life of a child of God reproves the sinner of his or her impure life." Let me repeat that first part of that quote. "The most uncomfortable place on earth for a lost sinner is in the presence of a consecrated Christian." Sometimes your very life is a confrontation to somebody. Do you think that people were comfortable being around Jesus? The Pharisees sure weren't. And even the sinners and the publicans weren't, though they would invite him over. But you find that every time they're around him, they're either repenting, at his feet weeping, because Jesus said, "If I had not come, they had not known that they had sin." I wonder if people realize when they're around you that they had sin. Too often we try to fit in with the world, that's contextualizing, rather than confronting. And I'll tell you something, contextualizing is a whole lot easier and comfortable. Confronting is hard. I hate confrontation. And yet I see it's necessary. 2.5 tribes seemed to do what provoked questions. We read about it in Numbers 32. They said, hey, we're going to stand this side Jordan. Moses said, no, wait a second. You're going to get us into the same trouble that Achan got us into. You mean we're going to go to war and you're going to sit over here? And they said, no. Please understand, we're going to go with you to war. And Moses said, okay. But if you don't do so, be sure your sin will find you out. We find those same 2 tribes in Joshua chapter 2, 22, again doing something that brings up questions. We're going to read this chapter in just a minute. But I want you to see in this chapter that there is repeated exhortation and warning and, here's the word, confrontation. Hey, you see a fellow Christian involved in a questionable activity and you do nothing because you hate to confront. The word confront means to come face to face with. You can tell when parents do not confront their children, can't you? They're obnoxious, they're spoiled, they're wild, because they've never been confronted. God told Eli that this was a problem he had with his 2 sons. Eli, you've never confronted your sons. A good parent will confront his or her children. 1 Timothy chapter 3 gives the qualifications for a pastor and again for a deacon. And in that chapter, one of those qualifications is ruling their children well. Now, why is that? I believe it's this way. Because if a man does not confront his children, then when it comes to a situation in church where somebody needs to be confronted, they won't do it. Because, well, I don't want to rock the boat. Folks, sometimes the boat needs to be rocked. Sometimes the boat needs to be overturned. Here we see in Joshua chapter 22 some lessons in biblical confrontation. Let me start by reading verses 1 through 9 of Joshua chapter 22. Then Joshua called the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh and said unto them, ye have kept all that Moses the servant of the Lord commanded you and have obeyed my voice in all that I have commanded you. Ye have not left your brethren these many days unto this day, but have kept the charge of the commandment of the Lord your God. And now the Lord your God hath given rest unto your brethren as he promised them. Now therefore return ye and get you unto your tents and unto the land of your possession, which Moses the servant of the Lord gave you on the other side Jordan. But take diligent heed to do the commandment and the law, which Moses the servant of the Lord charged you, to love the Lord your God and to walk in all his ways and to keep his commandments and to cleave unto him and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. So Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went unto their tents. Now to the one half of the tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given possession in Bashan. But unto the other half thereof gave Joshua among their brethren on this side Jordan westward. And when Joshua sent them away also unto their tents, then he blessed them. And he spake unto them, saying, return with much riches unto your tents, and with very much cattle, with silver, and with gold, and with brass, and with iron, and with very much raiment. Divide the spoil of your enemies with your brethren. And the children of Reuben, and the children of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh returned, and departed from the children of Israel out of Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan, to go unto the country of Gilead, to the land of their possession, whereof they were possessed, according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moses. Folks, this is great. They had done what they said they were going to do. You go back to Numbers chapter 32, where they said, hey, here's what we're going to do, but we're going to go armed before you. Moses said, okay, you be careful, because be sure your sin will find you out. They did what they said they were going to do. You know, that's rare today to find somebody who's going to do what they say they're going to do. For Christians, it ought to always be that when you say you're going to do something, you do it. That when you say you're going to be somewhere, you're there. And that you do it at the time you say you're going to be there. It's hard to find a dependable Christian. And that's sad. To complete your work. Listen, you're on a committee here at Westside. Fulfill your work. Don't leave it to the others. You're in the nursery. Listen, fulfill your work. In fact, we need more people to help out with that, folks. We're being strained there. Help out. You're a member here of a lady. You need to be in the nursery. You need to help out. Do what you say you're going to do. But here we see that utopia precedes confrontation. You know how some people assess situations before they're confronted? Everything was going so well before such and such rocked the boat. But I see that these tribes, these 2.5 tribes, gave reason for commendation. In the first four verses, they had fulfilled their obligation. They did what they said they would do. The tribes also gave reason for concern in verses 5 and 6. Because the exhortation is given out of concern. Why is Joshua giving them this exhortation in verses 5 and 6 to make sure you follow the laws that have been given to you? Because there is a divide. There is a river, the Jordan River, that separates them from the rest of Israel. These people would be east of the Jordan. Everybody else is west of the Jordan. And so out of concern, Joshua says what he says in verses 5 and 6. Take diligent heed to do the commandment and the law. So this utopia, so to speak, precedes confrontation. But now we're going to see in verses 10 to 29, upheaval accompanies confrontation. I know this is long, but I would like for you to follow as I read these 19 or 20 verses, verses 10 to 29. Please follow. Verse 10. And when they came unto the borders of Jordan, that are in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh built there an altar by Jordan, a great altar to see. And the children of Israel heard say, behold, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh have built an altar over against the land of Canaan in the borders of Jordan at the passage of the children of Israel. And when the children of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered themselves together at Shiloh to go up to war against them. And the children of Israel sent unto the children of Reuben and to the children of Gad and to the half tribe of Manasseh into the land of Gilead, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and with him 10 princes, of each chief house a prince throughout all the tribes of Israel. And each one was an head of the house of their fathers among the thousands of Israel. And they came unto the children of Reuben, and to the children of Gad, and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, unto the land of Gilead. And they spake with them, saying, thus saith the whole congregation of the Lord, what trespass is this that ye have committed against the God of Israel, to turn away this day from following the Lord, in that ye have builded you an altar, that ye might rebel this day against the Lord? Is the iniquity of Peor too little for us, from which we are not cleansed until this day? Although there was a plague in the congregation of the Lord, but that ye must turn away this day from following the Lord. And it will be, seeing ye rebel today against the Lord, that tomorrow he will be wroth with the whole congregation of Israel. Notwithstanding, if the land of your possession be unclean, then pass ye over unto the land of the possession of the Lord, wherein the Lord's tabernacle dwelleth, and take possession among us. But rebel not against the Lord, nor rebel against us, in building you an altar beside the altar of the Lord our God. Did not Achan, the son of Zerah, commit a trespass in the accursed thing, and wrath fell on all the congregation of Israel? And that man perished not alone in his iniquity. So, folks, here we see the uprightness of the confronter. Who's doing the confronting? The West tribes. They are confronting, in fact, they're ready to go to war to their brethren on the east of the Jordan. You see, the Canaanites, in whose land they now dwelt, had many altars for idolatrous worship. They would have an altar here, they'd have an altar there, they'd have altars everywhere so that they could worship in various places throughout the land. But God had warned the children of Israel to completely destroy all of these altars. And God had clearly outlined, you'll find this in Deuteronomy chapter 12, there was to be one location of offering and sacrifice. One location. Not two, not three, one. And it appears now that some of their brethren were violating. Because as soon as they crossed the River Jordan, they built an altar in addition to the one that God had prescribed. And their lack of communication with their brethren aroused suspicion. Furthermore, the size of the altar aroused suspicion. Did you see that in verse 10, the last part? It was a great altar to see. And so the western tribes are suspecting, here's apostasy. These tribes are apostatizing. They are abandoning their allegiance to God. They are repudiating God's law. And they could choose to ignore this problem, hoping it would go away. And that's typically what we would do. We would see a problem with somebody, we would choose to ignore it. Contextualize it. Sometimes there's a symptom of a disease that we would rather ignore than deal with. Because we don't want to know the truth. We're afraid to face the truth. And apostasy, folks, spreads like disease. Promoted by false teachers. And then by naive believers who are more concerned about unity than about purity. More concerned about happiness than holiness. Randy Yeagley once said, no Christian can act as if spiritual declension in any sector of the church is not his problem. Folks, the holiness of God and the holiness of his people demands no compromise. These are serious allegations. Look at verse 16. They're talking about trespass. That is unfaithfulness to a covenantal agreement with God. It is apostasy in spite of God's goodness in the eyes of these western tribes. These tribes are apostatizing. But I'm sure we would say, well, I'm uneasy about how I'm going to be perceived. If I confront somebody, they're going to perceive me in the wrong way. You know what? Those who have a concern for righteousness are always viewed as prudes. Scoffed at as a bunch of Puritans. You remember Joseph in the Old Testament there in Genesis when he would confront his brothers and he would go and tell Dad about his brothers and how they always viewed him as this little goody two-shoes? In this world of victims we have today, who's viewed as the evil one? The confronter is. That's how people view law enforcement today. Law enforcement does their job, and who's viewed as the bad guy? Not the perp. Not the criminal. It's the law enforcement agent who confronts the criminal. Now he's the problem. And I say the same thing has crept into churches. In the mind of liberals, you're supposed to wait until it's too late to do anything. And that only allows wickedness to become entrenched. Sometimes the confronters are viewed as being judgmental. And we ignore Matthew 18. But what the sons of Israel do here was proactive. They want to deal with this before greater problems. And they had learned their lesson, folks. They learned to confront. Because, did you see what was mentioned here? The iniquity of Peor in verses 17 and 18. They learned the lesson of the iniquity of Peor. Do you remember what happened there when the children of Israel were committing fornication with the Moabites? And there was one man out of the tribe of Israel, his name was Phinehas, who got up and took a javelin and took care of the problem. He confronted the problem. Guess who is leading the delegation here? The same Phinehas. It says in verse 17, it was a sin from which we are not cleansed until this day. In other words, many were still attached to the idolatry of the iniquity of Peor to that day. But the majority had learned the lesson of the iniquity of Peor. Secondly, they had learned the lesson of the iniquity of Achan. They had learned in the case of Achan that toleration of sin in one affects everybody. And those who do the confronting are often called unloving. But they really are the compassionate ones. Because they seek to avert the chastisement of the Lord upon the disobedient and the rebellious. God had given instructions on how to deal with what looked like apostasy. You can read it later in Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 12 to 18. Where he says, if you see a city that seems to be going wrong, you go and you confront them. And if you find it to be true, destroy the city. So that's the Old Testament, you say. That's unloving. Well, let me take you to another Old Testament verse that tells you that this is done out of love. Leviticus chapter 19, please. Leviticus chapter 19. It says in verse 17 of Leviticus 19, thou shalt not hate thy brother in thine heart. Thou shalt in any wise rebuke thy neighbor and not suffer sin upon him. Folks, if you read this verse, you're going to understand that not to confront somebody is to not love them. What do you think of a parent who never confronts their child? Do you say that child loves the children? Or that parent loves the children? Or is it the parent who takes the time, the energy, and sometimes the heartache to confront a child? Which one loves the child? It's the one who does the confronting. For whom the Lord loveth, he chastens. The parent who loves chastens. The believer who loves confronts a wayward brother. Look what follows in verse 18 of Leviticus 19. Thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt, here it is, love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord. In other words, if you don't confront him, if you don't rebuke him, like it says in verse 17, you're going to hold the grudge, verse 18. And it'd be better just to get it out in the open. The theological word book of the Old Testament says this on this about this verse where the word rebuke is used in Leviticus 19:17. About that word, it says confrontation, rebuke, correction is to be considered, therefore, as an integral part of brotherly love. So we see the uprightness of the confronter. But now let's look at the understanding of the ones who are confronted back in Joshua chapter 22. Look at verse 21. Then the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh answered and said unto the heads of the thousands of Israel, the Lord God of gods, the Lord God of gods, he knoweth, and Israel he shall know, if it be in rebellion or if in transgression against the Lord, save us not this day, that we have built us an altar to turn from following the Lord, or if to offer thereon burnt offering or meat offering, or if to offer peace offerings thereon, let the Lord himself require it. And if we have not rather done it for fear of this thing, saying, in time to come, your children might speak unto our children, saying, what have ye to do with the God of Israel? For the Lord hath made Jordan a border between us and you, ye children of Reuben and us of Gad. Ye have no part in the Lord, so shall your children make our children cease from fearing the Lord. Therefore we said, let us now prepare to build us an altar, not for burnt offering, nor for sacrifice, but that it may be a witness between us and you. and our generations after us, that we might do the service of the Lord before Him with our burnt offerings and with our sacrifices and with our peace offerings, that your children may not say to our children in the time to come, ye have no part in the Lord. Therefore said we, that it shall be, when they should so say to us or to our generations in time to come, that we may say again, behold, the pattern of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, not for burnt offerings, nor for sacrifices, but it is a witness between us and you. God forbid that we should rebel against the Lord and turn this day from following the Lord to build an altar for burnt offerings, for meat offerings, or for sacrifices beside the altar of the Lord our God that is before His tabernacle. Now, how would you respond? Here you came and you thought these people are doing something that is wicked, and then they respond this way. By the way, did you notice how they respond? They respond in humility. They respond out of concern. There's one of three ways to respond to confrontation. Here's one way to respond. You are right. I'm wrong. That's how David responded when Nathan confronted him about his sin. David said, I have sinned. That's one response. Here's another response. You have no right. And when somebody says that, they're trying to force a change of focus. They're attempting to move the attention from themselves to the one doing the confronting. You know, there's a lot in the Bible about people who did a lot of confronting and they were not liked. Who do you think more highly of, Elijah or Ahab? Who did the confronting? Elijah. Who hated Elijah? Ahab. Who do you think more of, Elijah or Jezebel? Who did the confronting here? Elijah. Who hated him? Jezebel. The confronted always hate the confronter. You'll read in the Bible about the prophets who confronted Israel. And what did the children of Israel do to the prophets who confronted them? Many times they killed them. Herod was confronted by John the Baptist. Herod had him beheaded. You have no right. And so they force a change of focus, or they force a change of guilt. They make you feel bad after all they have done for you, and I can't believe that you would doubt me. Look at all that we did for you. We got you into the land, these 2.5 tribes could say. We fought for 7 years for you. Look at all that we did, and now you're confronting us. That's not what they say. But that's typically how some people would respond. When some people are confronted, they get all upset. And they say, I can't believe that you would think that about me. Folks, when I confront somebody and somebody blows up and gets defensive, it only makes me suspect that I was right all along. Don't judge a man for doubting you. Judge yourself for giving a man reason to doubt you in the first place. And that's what these 2.5 tribes did. They judged themselves and said, oh, now we see what you're thinking. And that brings us to the third way to respond to confrontation. You have some right. We see why you think what you think. And rather than being defensive, they were devastated at their brother's perception of them. And they are emphatic that in spite of the appearance, verse 29, this is no rival altar. Their reaction to the allegations is evidence that there is nothing sinister about what they're doing. And they would not admit wrongdoing. Why? Because they had done no wrong. You know, the thing today to do is if somebody accuses you of doing something wrong, the confronted will sometimes say, well, rather than rock the boat, I'll just go ahead and admit it. Listen, if you admit that you did something that you did not do, that is called a... it's a lie. And yet that is even popular today. Well, so as to not rock the boat, I'll just admit my guilt and then we can all go on. It's popular to admit wrong for the sake of unity. Somebody tried to force me once to apologize for somebody having left the church. I refused. And I said, what did I do wrong? Well, you just need to apologize them so they'll come back. What did I do wrong? I cannot lie and apologize for something I did not do. What we did was right, and we will not apologize for it. And yet that's what people want you to do today. Upheaval accompanies confrontation. But we're going to see, lastly, that unity follows confrontation. Unity follows confrontation. By the way, that's the goal of confrontation. That's the goal of church discipline, is to see someone restored to fellowship. That's the goal. It's unity. It's reconciliation. Note verses 30 to 34. And when Phinehas the priest and the princes of the congregation and heads of the thousands of Israel which were with him heard the words that the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the children of Manasseh spake, it pleased them. And Phinehas the son of Eleazar the priest said unto the children of Reuben and to the children of Gad and to the children of Manasseh, this day we perceive that the Lord is among us, because ye have not committed this trespass against the Lord. Now ye have delivered the children of Israel out of the hand of the Lord. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and the princes returned from the children of Reuben and from the children of Gad out of the land of Gilead unto the land of Canaan to the children of Israel and brought them word again. And the thing pleased the children of Israel, and the children of Israel blessed God and did not intend to go up against them in battle to destroy the land wherein the children of Reuben and Gad dwelt. And the children of Reuben and the children of Gad called the altar witness, or Ed, for it shall be a witness between us that the Lord is God. I love this ending. But it all happened because somebody did some confronting. Either the confronted understands that he made a mistake and repents, or the confronter understands that he misunderstood and is relieved. Folks, the chance of upheaval caused by confrontation is worth it. Having understanding rather than ongoing suspicion results in unity. And now we can carry on the work. The object of controversy actually became a witness between us that the Lord is God. This altar, which could have eventually become used wrongly, now is unlikely ever to be used as such. Why? Because someone fortunately had said something that needed to be said. Both sides were mistaken. But it came out into the clear, because someone took the time to confront. Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, you which are spiritual, restore such an one in the spirit of weakness, in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted. Each of us has a responsibility to others. Not to hide something and to get grudges and to build up grudges against somebody, but to confront. Confront is not necessarily a negative word. And confront doesn't necessarily mean that you're in their face. It simply means that you present to somebody a problem that you say, you know what, I think there's this problem and I just need to make sure that this is clear. This one incident is treated in detail in a book about inheriting the possession. Why? Because it illustrates the principle of holiness, the importance of purity, even at the cost of temporary disunity. It is compromise, folks, that leads to disunity. It is zealousness for God and His Word that leads to both unity and purity, as illustrated in this chapter. And in the end, God is glorified. Father, I pray that we